One more day. I'm Tanzina Vega, and today in the takeaway for Monday, November 2nd, it's report card day. How has President Trump done in almost 4 years on the job? And what does former Vice President Joe Biden want to change for the country? We're breaking it all down. Plus,
Foxconn founder Terry Guo makes these sorts of overtures frequently, and often nothing comes of them. Factories that he promises often don't arrive, but the Trump administration really ran with this proposal.
How one factory in Wisconsin never really got off the ground, despite the president's efforts and promises to boost jobs. And we're hearing from those of you who have already voted.
This was my first time voting as an American citizen. It was very exciting. I was able to vote early yesterday in St. Petersburg, and there was no wait time at all.
But first, for many Americans, this is the most consequential election of their lifetime. Since the spring, hundreds of thousands of Americans have died from COVID-19, and every week infections are rising at unprecedented rates. More than 8 million Americans have been pushed into poverty, many fearing they won't be able to feed themselves or their families. Others are struggling to keep a roof over their head while scrambling to find work. The country is also reckoning with systematic and historical mistreatment of women and people of color. Protests have reached a fever pitch on both sides of the political divide. As a result, Americans are taking to the polls in droves. So far, more than 93 million people have voted early, many waiting on long lines in the heat or the rain, sometimes for hours. Today on the show, a final look at both presidential candidates, and we begin with the incumbent. During his 2016 campaign, candidate Donald Trump appealed to his base by promising a myriad of actions to, as he said, make America great again.
I pledge to every citizen of our land that I will be president for all Americans.
I will build a great, great wall on our southern border, and I will have Mexico pay for that wall.
We are going to fix our inner cities.
We're going to repeal Obamacare and replace it with something much better.
And rebuild our highways, bridges, tunnels, airports, schools, hospitals.
We are going to renegotiate the disaster known as NAFTA. We're going to renegotiate.
Finally, take care of our great veterans. I'm pro-life. The judges will be pro-life. We will get along with all other nations willing to get along with us.
We're going to drain the swamp of Washington
and have the strongest economy anywhere in the world.
I alone can fix it.
And now, 4 years on, and with Election Day tomorrow, the big question is, has President Trump kept his promises? Anita Kumar is with me, and she's a White House correspondent for Politico. Anita, welcome to the show.
Sure. Thanks for having me back.
So on the takeaway, Anita, we have a few guiding principles, foundations of the show, things we observe in this country. They include three gaps: the truth gap, the wealth gap, and the empathy gap. If we use those gaps as a guide, how has the president done, Anita, in truth?
Well, we've seen him exaggerate a lot. We've seen him lie a lot. We've seen him mostly recently on the campaign trail talking about his accomplishments. But some of those accomplishments didn't happen under his watch. Some of them didn't happen at all. So it's not been good for the last few years, particularly the last few months.
Let's talk a little bit about how he's done in terms of the wealth gap, which the way we define it is how communities of color are often earn less wealth than their white counterparts. Has that gap grown?
Yeah, I don't think he's really changed it that much. You know, there's been some things that have helped some people. There's been some things that have hurt. You know, one of his biggest accomplishments was the tax cuts back in his first year in office. And while it did impact all Americans, it primarily helped those that are wealthy. So not the part of society that you're talking about.
And finally, the empathy gap.
Well, that's probably the biggest one that a lot of people talk about, which is looking at primarily his immigration policy and his rhetoric that people would say there's a lot lacking there. I mean, that's what Joe Biden is primarily campaigning on, that Donald Trump doesn't have the empathy to be president, both in his policies. And you mentioned coronavirus, talking a little bit about what's happening there, but also in just what his everyday language is. And, you know, as he's been campaigning at these rallies, some of that rhetoric gets even more strong and pronounced, what some of those things are that they're talking about. So, you know, if you're the Democrats and you're Joe Biden, you would definitely say that is where he's lacking.
And yet many of his supporters actually like the president because of that lack of empathy.
You're exactly right. When I talk to supporters all over the country, one of the first things that they say about him is that they like that he is brash and that he says exactly what he's thinking and he doesn't hold back. It's one of the biggest appeals of Donald Trump to them.
So let's kind of go through this report card on how the president has done outside of those gaps, Anita. One of the most, top of mind things right now for many people is the Supreme Court of the United States. The president, and one of his biggest promises to the country when he took office, was to reshape not only the Supreme Court, but the federal judiciary writ large. Many would say, at the very least, at the Supreme Court, he's achieved that. What's your assessment, Anita, of how the president has done reshaping the courts?
This is definitely one of his biggest achievements. Not only the Supreme Court, which of course gets most of the attention, he has obviously three justices now, one third of the court, but he has appointed and gotten the Senate to confirm more than 200 judges, about 220. And it's not just that it's a lot, it's reshaped certain courts. So there are certain courts, appellate courts, federal courts that have flipped. So, you know, they were liberal-leaning, now they're conservative-leaning. There are some that have moved more to be conservative. Overall, he has about a fourth of the active federal judges in America. That's a huge number, and it's going to outlive him. It's going to outlive his presidency. This is something that's going to change the court system for, you know, a generation and years to come.
In terms of all of the promises he's made, and we're going to go through them by topic, I would almost say that this is probably one of the most significant changes in terms of the legacy, if the president is not reelected, that he will leave behind.
Definitely agree with you. And one of the reasons is not just the sheer number, it's that judges stay for a long time, right? It's not an executive order or even a law that can be changed by Congress in a year or 2 years. It's something that's going to last for quite a long time because these are appointments. I mean, look at the Supreme Court, lifetime appointments. And, you know, this is changing the Supreme Court, you know, which was 5-4. You know, the latest justice is changing, a liberal justice to a conservative. So now we're 6-3. That's going to change issues all over the country for years to come.
Let's turn to criminal justice for a second. The president has made promises to reform criminal justice. One of the ways that he's attempted to do that is through something called the First Step Act. Anita, what is that and how successful has it been?
You know, this is a really confusing one because he talked in 2016 and he's still talking about it in 2020 about being tougher on crime, you know, putting people away and all that sort of stuff. He's talked about specific cases. He talks about it in general. But actually, the First Step Act, which was a bipartisan law that Congress passed and he signed into law, really does try to deal with some of, you know, reducing sentences and sentencing disparities. It was, praised by African Americans and Democrats. And so it sort of goes against some of the rhetoric he's talking about. But people say it didn't go far enough on this particular issue. This was negotiated by his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, in the White House. So it's sort of a mixed bag. Definitely this was the biggest thing he's done on this issue. But people say hasn't gone far enough.
You mentioned the president's rhetoric, law and order, tough on crime. I mean, that's a lot often considered, particularly law and order, considered a racial dog whistle for many. But he's also really made a big effort, the president has, in terms of getting support from police and police unions and military personnel, and at the same time being at odds with top military officials. What would you assess his record to be with military personnel?
Yeah, it's a really interesting contradiction there. It seems like it, you know, but the police is sort of, you know, local police. That's what he's generally talking about when he's talking about police. You know, he accuses Joe Biden of trying to defund the police, which he's not. But, you know, he is at odds with the military officials in his own administration, even top officials. If he gets a second term, we're thinking that there's going to be changes, even perhaps at the Pentagon, perhaps the secretary over there of defense. It's partly because of what his promise was in 2016. He said he was going to end America's endless wars. Now, he did not do that. I will say that every president recently has come in and said, you know, I remember Barack Obama saying the same thing. We're going to get out of Afghanistan. It didn't happen. It's a very tough thing when you get into office and, you know, your military officials, advisors tell you if you do this, harm will come to that region. And so he has tried to do it. He has reduced troop numbers, but he didn't get where he wanted. And that was mostly he was at odds with those military officials who kept pushing him not to do that. So over and over again, you saw him not agreeing with them.
We also heard at the top, Anita, that he pledged to take care of America's veterans. But when President Trump was candidate Trump, he got into a lot of criticism for comments that he made about John McCain. How has he done treating American veterans?
Well, he likes to talk about this a lot, and he mentions actually a bill that passed that did help veterans, and people say that it did, but it actually didn't pass under his tenure. There was some efforts made at the end of the Obama administration to help veterans primarily with health care. But you mentioned, I'm glad you mentioned the rhetoric, because if people are listening, that's probably the thing they remember the most, right? It's what he said about veterans or what people, what these leaks have been that he has said about military officials and veterans. You mentioned John McCain. He denies that. He says that he has always been supportive. So it's a little bit unclear, right? Behind the scenes, is he really saying some of these things or not? Of course, he claims he doesn't say these things about John McCain, but we've actually seen him say those publicly.
Anita, one of the other things we talked about is are the tax cuts that the president promised to Americans. And I'm wondering, you know, tax cuts are one thing, but there are also unemployment numbers that have come out. And the most recent unemployment numbers say the unemployment rate declined to 7.9%. That's according to the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics. Does that give us a sense of how the Trump economy has done?
Well, the economy was doing well before. There were signs that it wasn't, but pretty, you know, we'd seen some growth in the end of the Obama administration. We saw some growth. Obviously, the pandemic came in. Unemployment hit about 15% or almost 15% and then has come down. So, you know, people argue that it's because of those things that he has put into place, deregulation and other things, that the economy is starting to turn back around.
He's also made a lot about the third quarter GDP numbers. A lot of people say the stock market is not the American kitchen table, if you will. But the president is saying the GDP growth was up over 33%. Does that matter?
You know, it matters to some people, I guess. It doesn't matter. You talked about that wealth gap before. It doesn't matter to some of those people that aren't feeling it, right? He likes to talk about the economy in terms of the stock market. That's one of his biggest things he talks about. But it doesn't impact every single person. Others would want him to do other things. There's no doubt about it, though. The economy has done well until the pandemic, and it's turning around. It's still in bad shape, though. So he's more to do.
Anita, let's turn to health care for a minute. It's a big issue on the minds of many voters. The president campaigned and talked a big game about ending the Affordable Care Act. He has not done that. What has stopped him?
Oh, so many things. Mostly Congress, I guess. You know, that was one of his biggest issues. He came in there, said he was going to repeal the Affordable Care Act. If you remember back to the beginning of his term, there was that vote in Congress, and this was that overnight vote in the middle of the night. Senator John McCain went in there and voted against this repeal. You know, the Republicans really had a hard time coming up with what they wanted the replacement to be. That was really the big problem. And so Republicans on Capitol Hill disagreed on what that should be. Three Republicans were against him in the Senate. He did not get that vote. He has since talked about it for 4 years. Even recently, he's saying he's going to come out with a new plan. Now, what the White House says is that he's cobbled together a lot of different things. He's done different executive orders, and overall, together, that makes up a health care plan. But it doesn't replace the Affordable Care Act, which is still in place. So to say he would replace it hasn't happened. Now, he is asking the Supreme Court to repeal it, to get rid of it completely. That won't happen until later at their next term, and we don't really know what's going to happen with that.
On the topic of healthcare, of course, we cannot not talk about the coronavirus pandemic. More than 230,000 Americans are dead so far as a result of that. President Trump promised a vaccine. He's been fighting with Anthony Fauci. He did start something called Operation Warp Speed. Where is that? Where does it stand?
You know, I mean, it's just really honestly a mixed bag. People say that he did not display that leadership. When you talk to local state officials and school officials, they did not get the tests and the supplies they needed fast enough. Even testing now is still lagging. You know, Americans might know that if they try to go get a test, it might be hard to get. It might take too long to get it. So that's really where we are. And of course, you mentioned the vaccine, which is hugely important, something that he promised would be available before November 3rd, which hasn't happened yet. Still waiting on that. And there are a number of promising, companies out there promising something, looking at something in these final stages, but still probably won't be around till next year.
Anita, in the first few weeks of President Trump's administration, I just remember the president signing a myriad of executive orders. He's continued to use executive orders as a way to get his policies through. How effective has that strategy been for the president so far?
Well, it's mixed. I will say a lot of presidents do that. I remember when President Obama, not less maybe in the beginning and more later, when Congress just wouldn't pass things that he wanted to pass. And he said, I'm going to use my phone and my pen. I still remember it. And that was really alluding to the fact that he was going to sign in executive orders. So it's been mixed. Some of them, you look at them and you say, well, that doesn't really do that much. It's an executive order for to study something or to put a task force together. And others, he's tried to do, something that's been much more significant. I'll remember right at the beginning of the administration where one of the first thing he signed was the travel ban. Remember, that was a big promise he made in 2016 to stop Muslims or some Muslims from coming into this country. So he tried that three different times. They were contested or challenged in court, and finally one stuck. So the third iteration of that did stay.
One place where the president has relied on executive orders is with immigration. He's used 400 executive orders actions so far to attempt to shut down asylum / refugee admissions. How successful has he been there? And I guess success depends on how you define it. The president's strategy has really been to dissuade people from entering the country rather than to deport them.
Yeah, I think this is one of the more significant where he's had more significant role than some other issues. So we mentioned, the travel ban. He has talked a lot about deporting everyone, all illegal people who are here illegally. That didn't happen. But he has carved into that and cut into that. And he's also cut into people that could come here. I remember one of the most significant things he did was stop foreign workers from coming. And he basically said, I'm not going to give visas to them. That's a huge number of people. We're talking about people with no skills. We're people talking about people with high skills, all of the above. He said he did that because of the coronavirus. But really, with that order, he was able to do that. So significant. Another significant immigration one was reducing the number of refugees he was allowing. It reached about 85,000 during the Obama term, and now he's looking at next year at 10 or 20,000. So it's really, really been reduced.
Anita, in an interview with NBC News, Stephen Miller, who's an advisor to the president, particularly on issues of immigration, laid out in a very aggressive plan, should the president be reelected, to include a freeze on immigration and punishing sanctuary cities. Is this along the lines of what the president has already outlined, and is it something that appeals to his base, should he be reelected?
Yeah, it really does appeal to his base. One of the remarkable things about 2020 is that this election really wasn't about immigration. I thought it would be, but obviously because of the pandemic, things got changed around. But I think still that message is there. He still wants to do certain things. What Stephen Miller was talking about were things that he had tried to do and didn't accomplish or along the same vein. So I do think that we're going to see more of that come next term if he's elected. Interesting, he mentioned sanctuary cities. That's something that President Trump has been trying on, and the courts have pushed him off of that. He has not been able to defund sanctuary cities.
And we should mention that New York is one of those cities. Anita Kumar is a White House correspondent for Politico. Anita, thanks so much for going through this report card with us.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
President Trump pledged to do many things when he took office in 2016. And while he's fulfilled some of those promises, he's failed on others. And that includes his promise to revive the industrial economies in key battleground states like Michigan, Ohio, and Wisconsin. In 2018, Trump promised to bring the Taiwanese company Foxconn to Wisconsin, and along with it, 13,000 jobs to reinvigorate manufacturing in the region. But today, more than 2 years later, Foxconn has only hired a few hundred employees, and the factory itself is largely being used as a storage facility. Josh Jezza is investigations editor and feature writer at The Verge, and he's here with me now. Josh, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
So why did Trump promise Foxconn was coming to Wisconsin? What was his political agenda there?
So if you think back to 2017, Trump was making a push to bring back manufacturing to the U.S. and particularly to Rust Belt states like Wisconsin. And the Foxconn deal began really right after he took office, when Foxconn's founder, Terry Guo, floats the idea of a large manufacturing presence in the U.S. And Guo makes these sorts of overtures frequently, and often nothing comes of them. Factories that he promises often don't arrive. But the Trump administration really ran with this proposal, arranged a meeting between Guo and Walker, then Governor Scott Walker, who then proceeded to offer the company an enormous subsidy package to build a 13,000 employee, 20 million square foot, large panel LCD factory in Wisconsin.
Now that has not materialized so far, the 13,000 jobs and everything else. What happened there? Why was it Foxconn that failed to deliver on its promise to Wisconsin?
There are a couple points of failure here. And the main one, the short answer, is that the factory Foxconn was proposing never really made commercial sense. There was a glut in the LCD industry that was foreseeable at the time. The cost of labor would have demolished the thin margins of the industry. There weren't suppliers in Wisconsin that Foxconn would need to be able to run this kind of facility. And Foxconn leadership, from what I've been able to find, was aware of this pretty shortly after the groundbreaking ceremony, if not before, and really started searching around for anything else to do in Wisconsin. And, you know, that would have been a short story if Foxconn concluded that what it had proposed wasn't going to work. But instead, Foxconn and supportive politicians, including the Trump administration, continued to insist that everything was on track and going well as the company vacillated wildly from plan to plan.
We keep saying there were 13,000 jobs promised. How many jobs have actually materialized, Josh?
So very few. The Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation found that at the end of last year, there were 281 employees eligible under the terms of the contract. At that time, Foxconn was supposed to have a little over 2,000, and it needed about 520 to get subsidies. That number was supposed to increase rapidly. It's supposed to reach 13,000 by 2022. Instead, it's going in the wrong direction. I found Foxconn laid people off beginning this year, shortly after the deadline to receive subsidies passed. So a small, small fraction of what Foxconn was supposed to employ.
President Trump touted the Foxconn plant as part of this major economic investment in the region. And we know that even more broadly, the president has really failed to keep that promise in the region, in Michigan, Wisconsin, Ohio. Is Foxconn one of the biggest examples of sort of promises not kept to bring back these types of jobs?
Foxconn was really a centerpiece of that effort. This was supposed to be a major employer, a new industry in the U.S., and in particular, an industry that is currently based almost entirely in China. And this was supposed to be an example of reshoring manufacturing and specifically a type of tech manufacturing that could be the foundation for a new industry in the U.S. And it really has not come to pass.
What does this tell us about, I mean, you mentioned China, and I know that President Trump has, well, we've all heard the president, you know, comments about China, everything from the coronavirus on down. This is a Taiwanese company. Does this tell us anything about the president's maybe broader geopolitical business strategy and wanting to do business with Taiwan versus China?
It's interesting. Foxconn is a Taiwanese company. Most of its manufacturing is in China, where it has these massive complexes, you know, hundreds of thousands of workers in some of them. And it's a major exporter from China. And I think Trump wanted to bring that back to the U.S., though I think the Foxconn project shows all the reasons why that is difficult. And in some ways, you have Trump policies working at cross purposes here, where the trade war, you know, made some of the things Foxconn was trying to do more difficult by raising the price of some of the supplies it would need to manufacture anything in the U.S.
What we know that Wisconsin is a key state in this election. It has been in prior elections, but this year in particular, with coronavirus, with everything that's going on, with recent Supreme Court decisions on ballot counting, Wisconsin has become even more critical to the overall election. Does this failure from the Trump administration and Foxconn actually matter to voters on the ground in Wisconsin?
I think we'll find out. My sense is there is general disappointment about the Foxconn project. Trump has continued to tout it. You know, even last month, he would mention it in rallies. He would talk about this wonderful factory and say Foxconn will bring even more investment if he's reelected. But I think it's apparent even to people who haven't been following the project closely that it's fallen short. You know, the giant factory is just not there. It's not employing nearly the number of people that it was supposed to at this point.
So where does the project go from here? Does it still continue to get funding from the state? I mean, are they going to just keep using it as a storage facility? With, I mean, your reporting really paints a picture of this, I can imagine, empty hallways sitting vacant.
Yeah, it's a good question. I'm really not sure where it goes from here. So the building that Foxconn calls the LCD factory, it was permitted for storage recently. A government report found that even if it were to be an LCD factory, it would be the smallest such factory in the world, that it's more of a display or demonstration facility than a viable business. But Foxconn has built it, and they've built several other buildings of unclear purpose. They have a lot of land that was provided by the state and local governments. They have this infrastructure there. It's unclear what Foxconn does from here. They have started some very small scale manufacturing of circuit boards, you know, something that would employ dozens to a few hundred people, not the 13,000. It's unclear to me whether Foxconn leaves Wisconsin or ekes out a small manufacturing presence. Its statements after the story ran said that it was disappointed to be denied subsidies. Terry Guo, in a separate statement, said that the company, paraphrasing, would remain a partner to places that were a good partner to Foxconn, and spoke highly of Trump specifically rather than a more broad comment about the U.S. administration. And there was a sense among employees that the fate of the Foxconn project hinged in part on the outcome of the election.
Josh Jezza is an investigations editor and feature writer at The Verge. Josh, thanks so much for your reporting.
Thanks for having me.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
There are four questions Jews ask to mark Passover every year. This Passover is leading many of us to ask more questions, once tied to our identity as Jewish Americans. I'm Matt Katz, and on the next Notes from America, we'll talk about hard conversations happening in Jewish communities right now, how we can heal our divisions, and why this Passover feels different. Available wherever you get podcasts.
And if Joe Biden ends up winning the presidential election, he'll have plenty of campaign promises to live up to. And that includes lofty goals the former vice president has said he'd get started as soon as he's sworn in.
If I'm your president, on day one, we'll implement the national strategy I've been laying out since March. We'll develop and deploy rapid tests with results available immediately.
If I have the honor of being president, I will end the Muslim ban on day one.
I'd make the changes on the corporate taxes on day one.
On day one, I'm sending to the United States Congress a immigration bill providing a pathway for 11 million undocumented, and I'm going to make sure every dreamer is protected now.
We're going to have to wait and see whether a potential Joe Biden administration can actually hit the ground running on all of those policies. For more, I'm joined by Jennifer Epstein, political reporter covering the Biden campaign for Bloomberg News. Jennifer, thanks for being with me.
Thanks for having me.
President Trump has downplayed the severity of the coronavirus even after contracting it himself, but Joe Biden has said he'd make some big changes if he became president. What would he do differently?
It goes from everything from encouraging mask wearing by leading by example on that, as he has during the campaign, wearing a mask himself all the time, except for when he's kind of at a microphone, socially distanced from anybody else on stage, launching a whole of federal government response to the pandemic that would be aggressively different, I think, than the Trump plan. He would not be fighting with some of the scientists. He would be listening to them, he has said, deploying the resources of the federal government. He plans to use a Defense Production Act more aggressively than President Trump has to kind of get industry to do its part, whether it's with PPE production or vaccine production down the line. He has a plan for the distribution of the vaccine, even just in defending the Affordable Care Act. He says that that will make vaccine distribution easier and free, and also will protect people who end up having long-term health issues because of their COVID cases, lung issues, or whatever else. So it really is a pretty comprehensive approach that touches on a whole lot of different areas. I think, you know, it's the public health response and then obviously also an economic response. He says that he will talk to governors and mayors about mask wearing to try to encourage them to put in their own mask mandates. He can't, you know, really order a federal mandate, despite kind of some of the stuff that the Trump people have said, but he can certainly encourage mask wearing, as I said before. It seems like he really just wants to bore down in every single area where the government can help fight this pandemic, is kind of a piece of what he plans to do.
Joe Biden would also inherit an economy right now that has been battered by the COVID-19 crisis. We mentioned at the top of the show that 8 million Americans have been pushed into poverty. People are scrambling to keep their homes, to put food on the table, to find work that may not return since this pandemic has taken hold of the country. Does Joe Biden have a plan for dealing with that economy should he inherit it as becoming president?
Yeah, he does. He has this economic plan called Build Back Better, which is a couple trillion dollars of spending that's meant to stimulate the economy. I think it will depend a little bit on the results of the election, whether Democrats win the Senate, if he wins the presidency, and whether there's any activity during the lame duck session of Congress on if the House and Senate can and the White House can agree on stimulus, you know, a couple trillion dollars of stimulus spending now through the end of the year, or if people are going to continue to kind of be in need and the government not act, in which case after Inauguration Day, Biden would move very quickly on a stimulus bill. I think that the size of it is still to be determined, and how much of that pulls on some of the ideas that are in his Build Back Better plan, which are things like clean energy spending, health and home aid and nursing care and things like that, which I think, you know, a lot of people would say are badly needed during the pandemic. So it will depend on sort of what happens before he were to become president. But there is definitely an intention to either add to whatever is done during a lame duck session this year, or to come through with a bigger plan than the couple trillion dollars that's being talked about, or had been negotiated a bit between Nancy Pelosi and the administration in the last couple months.
This also would rely very much on how who is in Congress, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it definitely does. You know, if Democrats have a majority in the Senate, I think you're looking and they're likely to keep their majority in the House. You're looking at a much bigger bill than if Republicans end up in control of the Senate still. You know, it could be the difference between it being $2 or $3 trillion or maybe five, or, you know, it really will depend on that and that alone.
Jennifer, last week, Joe Biden announced a plan that would create a task force to reunite the 545 migrant children who were separated from their families under the Trump administration, and whose parents, advocates, and lawyers say they are still unable to find. What would that task force actually be able to do? Because it seems like a task force is very Washington for "we don't know what to do yet."
Yeah, it certainly seems like something that the campaign kind of scrambled to put out to seem responsive to this. I you know, have covered the family separation issue closely a couple of years ago, and I know that the ACLU and other groups have been working really hard to match up these kids with their parents, find their parents who may not be in the U.S. anymore. And I think the federal government does have a lot of resources around, you know, everything from they have people on the ground in the Central American countries that these kids came from, you know, so but the campaign has not really detailed what this would look like or how they would do something that all of these advocacy groups have been unable to do over the last 2 years and find these parents to reunite them with their kids. So I think that kind of remains to be seen exactly how that would work.
Joe Biden has also made multiple promises about how he'd overhaul the Trump administration's immigration policy, specifically how it relates to DACA and trying to make those protections permanent. So if Joe Biden wins and the Democrats don't take the Senate, would he be able to do that through executive order?
His campaign has not said exactly how he would intend to do that if that were the case. I think he may try to do that through executive order, which I think would then be challenged in the courts and get up to the Supreme Court. And now that the Supreme Court is pretty clearly not in Democrats' favor, I would assume that that would get struck down. But I think that that's probably the way that they would go. I mean, maybe they would be able to come to a deal, even with a Republican Senate, as part of a bigger bill that has other priorities that Republicans favor, something like defense spending. It's unclear exactly how that would happen. I think a lot of the things that Biden has proposed, there's always a piece of it that kind of assumes that he'll have a Congress that will work with him, whether it's a Republican majority or Democratic one. And that's certainly something that until recently he was saying quite a bit on the campaign trail, that he thought that once Donald Trump was out of office, there would be some Republicans who would be eager to work with him. But he has sort of backed away from that message, I think, in seeing just how white-knuckled they were in the Amy Coney Barrett confirmation process, getting through that process in about a month, that he is, I think, more skeptical now than ever before about the prospect of working with Republicans. And I think that that would pose a challenge on immigration and lots of other issues.
We've talked a lot in the previous segments about President Trump's immigration policies, but using his policies to dissuade people from even attempting to enter the United States. However, Joe Biden was vice president during the Obama administration, and Obama himself was called the deporter in chief for his aggressive policies to deport people from the United States. Joe Biden has also made a point of distancing himself from some of those failed immigration reforms under the Obama administration. What's his plan to go forward should he become president?
One piece of his plan, and that one issue that has created a lot of the issues at the border, is to kind of reinvigorate the programs that allow for refugees and asylum seekers to apply for status in the U.S. You know, the Trump administration has been really strict around people seeking asylum at the southern border, and Biden has made clear that he would kind of reverse the policy and go back to a time when somebody could you know, cross the border and apply for that status if they are, you know, found by authorities. So I think that you're just going to see, a revamping of those agencies and the State Department and the Department of Homeland Security to make it possible for people to go through the process as it has previously existed to become true pieces of the immigration system in the U.S.
Another part of his legacy that has been a large point of criticism for Joe Biden, it was the 1994 crime bill that he authored. Last month, he called the crime bill, quote, a mistake. How do Black and brown Americans in particular look at Joe Biden in this light? I mean, does he have a current criminal justice reform plan that looks markedly different than the crime bill?
Yeah, he does. You know, there are two crime bills. There was a 1986 bill and a 1994 bill. The 1986 one had tough drug laws that created a situation where people of color oftentimes got punished much more harshly than white people, the kind of the crack and cocaine sentencing disparity. And so he has said that much of that was a mistake, but he has also said Black leaders were on his side on this. And it's true, the Congressional Black Caucus, faith leaders and community leaders were all in favor of those bills at the time. And they say that they were doing what they believed was best at the time, and that obviously, you know, the way that those policies were carried out was really detrimental to those communities. So Biden is proposing to basically get rid of, you know, a lot of the criminal penalties for any kind of drug offenses, to release people who are in jail for those offenses now, to work on drug treatment issues as a way to help people rather than kind of punish people. So there's a whole lot he's just going to do on the drug piece. And then just in terms of broader criminal justice reform, he was, you know, attacked pretty roundly by the president and by other Republicans for kind of being on the same side as people who are protesting to defund the police. And he has made very clear he does not want to defund the police. In fact, he wants to spend more, not just on policing, but on sort of supporting police officers and with mental health people who could, you know, deal with a situation like what just happened in Philadelphia. So he has a lot of different plans there.
Jennifer Epstein is a political reporter covering the Biden campaign for Bloomberg News. Jennifer, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, everybody, that's a Monday in the books. And don't forget, tomorrow is Election Day. If you haven't already voted, now's the time. And if you've already voted, call us and tell us your experience.
This is Terry from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And I received my mail-in ballot and filled it out and took it into my county's satellite polling place a couple of weeks ago. And I had the most fun doing that. The parking was great. The organization was great. The poll workers were wonderful. And, you know, everybody just felt a little jubilant, I think, voting that way.
This is Marley calling from Seattle, Washington, and I'm a little jealous of everybody voting in person. I have only ever voted by mail, first as an absentee voter in college, and now Washington has all vote by mail. which is wonderful. I can sit at home and do my research and vote in the comfort of my own home. But it does seem like there's a certain bit of excitement and community that's happening at the polls that you just don't get when you're voting from the comfort of your own home.
This is Chris Peoples, and I'm calling from Oakland, California. And I had a very pleasant experience voting early. I voted at 2 o'clock on a Tuesday, and they had a booth outside the courthouse where you gave them your name and gave them your cell phone number. And you hung around for 10 or 15 minutes until they beeped your cell phone. And then I went downstairs in the basement, and voted. It worked just fine.
My name is Andrew Check. I'm an active duty officer in the United States Army, and I voted by mail with my military absentee ballot. Currently stationed in New York City, part of the New York City Recruiting Battalion, living in Brooklyn, New York. It was a very exciting time to be able to vote, and I appreciate the fact that I was able to vote by mail.
My name is Erica Rodriguez. I'm calling from St. Petersburg, Florida. This was my first time voting as an American citizen, so it was very exciting. I was able to vote early yesterday in St. Petersburg, and there was no wait time at all. So it was a very easy process.
This is Jay from San Jose. And yes, we already voted by mail and already verified with our register of voters that our votes have been received and counted. So our experience was very safe and neat, and it's over.
877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. We'll be with you all week with our usual analysis. And of course, you can send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.